Morning, everybody. Welcome to our latest Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment Law and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are based in the south of England and we work with businesses that are based all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
And no traffic woes for you this morning, I don't think, in terms
Not
of
yet.
commute, in terms of commute. Just a couple of housekeeping matters. I've mentioned you can use the chat functions. Please do that. Questions and answers, try and deal with them as they come up because you are taking the trouble to join us live today. So by all means, just use the Q&A function down at the bottom if you want to ask a question and we'll deal with it as we go, hopefully. These sessions are being recorded. You will know by now you can get the recording of the video on our website, npmlegal.co.uk, and you can get the audio recording on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and wherever else you listen to your podcast. So please do check out Employment Law 101 in those places. What are we talking about today? Well, we're digging into quite a critical area of employment law, and it's an area that kind of transcends culture, process, risk, and that is whistleblowing, or more precisely, when employees make what's called protected disclosures. We're going to cover what the law requires, some practical steps that HR and legal teams need to be mindful of, what the traps are to avoid, and a quick look as well at some of the reforms in this area as a result of the Employment Rights Bill, still not law, by the way, and the proposed Office of the Whistleblower.
That's right. So, look, whistleblowing isn't just a legal phrase. It is starting to come up more and more, but for your organizations, it can often mean major reputational or even regulatory risk. Or conversely, it can mean that you have an opportunity to strengthen that trust, the culture and compliance issues within the business. So understanding both the letter of the law and sort of like the HR slash people implications is vital. What I would say, it's a huge topic, as I'm sure you can imagine, and we haven't got that long. So, but what we're aiming to do is to give you some nubs of the key parts, and hopefully some tips about how to get ahead of this stuff and how to deal with it. So,
Yeah, just
over
some of the
to you.
headlines, really. I mean, we know that in terms of litigating whistleblowing claims, they can be exceedingly complex. And there are lots of authorities that have gone right up to, I think, Supreme Court level, certainly Court of Appeal level, dealing with the intricacies of it. You may be pleased to know we're not going to go into those intricacies in the next 27 minutes. But if you've got a particular interest in this area and you want to pick our brains on it, then by all means, get in touch with us. So just starting with these basics then, what do we mean by whistleblowing slash making a protected disclosure? Well, in England, the main bit of legislation that's dealing with this is the Employment Rights Act, which I know that most of you will be familiar with. The government guidance puts it like this: you're a whistleblower if you're a worker and you report certain types of wrongdoing, and the wrongdoing you disclose must be in the public interest. Now, ACAS say in the public interest means it also has to affect others. So, for example, other workers, customers, the general public, they all need to be affected. A problem or a grievance that's personal to you is unlikely to count as being in the public interest. So there must be a disclosure of information that, in the reasonable belief of the worker making that disclosure, tends to show that one of the following is occurring. And I'm going to use some of the examples that ACAS provide on their website because they're good ones. So the first is a criminal offence. So that could be a business that is bribing somebody. The second is a breach of any legal obligation. And the example there is an employer neglecting their duty of care to children in a care home. So if they're a, children's care home provider, it could be a miscarriage of justice. So the example ACAS give is a staff member dismissed for something that turned out to be a computer error. There's a, justice failure point there. Danger to the health and safety of any individual. So an employer forcing staff to serve contaminated food is the example given. Damage to the environment. So a business that's regularly polluting a river, for example. And the final category is the deliberate concealing of information about any of those things above. So that would bring you within the ambit of protection as well.
Exactly. So, like, just breaking that down a little bit. So, who can actually blow the whistle? Well, it's not just your employees. It's that wider definition of worker. So, we're talking agency workers, trainees, consultants. Anybody like that will have the protection. And so if you get those types of complaints from somebody who isn't an employee, don't just dismiss it out of hand. That's something where you have to stop and think, well, hang on a second, you know, they've raised this, what do we need to do? Would be the first sort of port of call. And when we're talking about the reporting of the types of wrongdoing that Peter's just run through, the disclosure has got to be of information which the person reasonably believes shows that there's this wrongdoing. Now, it used to be that the employee had to bring it in good faith, but in actual fact, the right test is they've got to have a reasonable belief. And I think one of the key things to remember, and people very often get sidetracked by this, is that it actually doesn't matter if the reported wrongdoing turns out to be incorrect, that the employee has got it wrong. You know, you may investigate it and go, no, there wasn't a miscarriage of justice. You know, the employees made that complaint, but no, that's not right. It was right. That's actually irrelevant to whether something is a protected disclosure, as long as the employee has the reasonable belief that there has been that wrongdoing. And very often, that's something that does get lost. Just in terms of the sort of like the public interest point, and with it not being a personal grievance, I think it's always worth looking. What, you know, is it in the public interest or is it just about an individual? So I can give you an example here. Say, for example, an employee comes to you and says, my manager's bullying me. They stand over me, they point the finger, they shout at me, you know, they're micromanaging me. And you know, and that's a risk to my mental health or my physical well-being, for example. Now, that doesn't have a public interest element. That is very specific, relating to an individual. But here's a nuance. So, say, for example, the employee says all of that stuff and then says, this is the way my manager behaves to all of my team and all of the people that they deal with. That's their behavior at work generally impacting, you know, other people are feeling the same way. Now, arguably, that's going to be in the public interest because it is a grievance about the particular behavior towards an individual, but it has a wider coverage in that other people are being impacted in the same way. So again, nuances can very often be missed, and that's just something to bear in mind. What about where the who the disclosures need to be made to? Well, normally needs to be made to one of the specified persons or channels. And normally in the employment context, we're talking about that being to the employer. And a lot of employers might have a prescribed person, for example. So, you know, it's looking at your whistleblowing policy. What are your reporting channels? You know, if you do get this type of disclosure in, what does your policy say in terms of who it needs to be reported to? So, you know, thinking about your policy, thinking about your responsiveness to disclosures, all of this matters. So it's not just a legal tick box. It's making sure that your organization is in good shape, ready to respond to, you know, handling a serious concern in this way, that both, you know, looks at the topic raised, but also looking at protecting the rights of the worker who's raised it. So.
No, absolutely. I think what I want to mention there as well is about the intersection here with settlement agreements and confidentiality provisions and gagging clauses, because there is an overlap. Anything that tries to stop workers from making disclosures is not going to be enforceable. So you can't block protected disclosures being made. So that's something to bear in mind if you're, if you're using settlement agreements or similar documents in terms of trying to capture legal liability. You do need to have some specific wording that's included in there, which adequately carves out effectively from other gagging provisions that relate specifically to whistleblowing.
Yeah, we've got professional rules on that as well. So that if you come to us and, you know, you say, can you do us a settlement agreement? Because, you know, there's been this grievance raised, there's been this complaint, but we're trying to reach a deal. We have to flag that to you. We have to put that into the agreement. And I think from your perspective, it's important to manage your manager's expectations of what can be closed down in a settlement agreement, because very often it'll be a case of somebody's raised something, we think we can just pay them, you know, some compensation to move forward, but there is this particular sort of window, if you like, which can't be shut. And I think that's important for the business to understand. And that and making sure the business understands will probably fall on your shoulders in your HR capacity. So just warning you about that.
That's a good point. What we want to talk about now are just some of the major themes in terms of dealing with whistleblowing. Starting off with recognizing what is a qualifying disclosure, because one of the first things to check is, does the disclosure meet the threshold of what constitutes a protected disclosure? If it doesn't, then the protections are unlikely to apply. Okay. So think back to what we've said about those defined failures, breach of a legal obligation, cr a criminal offence being committed, concealment, anything like that. That's what you're pegging it back to.
And looking at the case law in this, I mean, we've looked at this quite a lot, and years ago did have sort of quite a big whistleblowing case, and worked quite closely with a barrister who's very experienced in this area, and we spent an awful lot of time digging into whether or not this was actually enough to meet that threshold of being a protected disclosure. Now, it's very fact specific, and it's something that the courts, the tribunals will look at, working through the tests. But very often, it depends very much on the circumstances. But I thought it would be quite handy to have an example. And when I was trying to think of an example, I've come up with quite a poor one. So apologies for that. But hopefully, it'll
Don't
help.
know what
So,
this is. This is going to be a surprise for me, so go
well, I was
on.
just thinking about how can we. It's all very well going, it might not meet the threshold, and people
Yeah,
go, well,
what is
what
it?
does that mean? And sometimes case law is really unhelpful because there isn't actually any specific definition in the law of what it is. So you're looking at the case law to try and draw out the principles. But this is where I got to. So forgive me if it is really basic. But say, for example, an employee says, you breach health and safety all the time, right? And then, something happens. You might want to discipline them. You might want to manage them. They come back and they say, I raised a protected disclosure because I complained about your health and safety. But that phrase, you breach health and safety all the time, that isn't going to be enough to be a protected disclosure. That's just a statement made. Contrast that with, you're always breaching health and safety. Look at the tools being left on the workshop floor. Those are a real danger to people working. All right, fact specific, pointing to information, giving detail about what the actual danger to health and safety is. Now, that's about as basic an example I could give, but that's more likely to meet the definition and the threshold of what is a protected disclosure, because it's raising something with an employer, giving the details, giving very, very specific facts, which arguably, well, certainly in this case, would require action, rectification action by the employer.
You
Does
just
that help?
in terms of that example, right? So where you're
Oh, you're going to
saying,
dig into my example.
no, not at all. But where you're saying, somebody raises a health and safety, somebody makes this bland kind of comment, you're not following health and safety procedures, full stop. And then you say, and the employer wants to dismiss them or manage them. Obviously, we mean they're unrelated. So, at a point in the future, there's an issue where you might need to take disciplinary action, or they might need management. And I've had this situation in litigation, a litigated matter before, where the employee is trying to then join the dots. So the employee is trying to make that bridge between me having raised a complaint about health and safety, which I will say was whistleblowing because I was specific, because I mentioned tools on the workshop floor. And you now, at a point in the future, trying to take some negative action against me as an employee. So maybe trying to make me redundant, trying to dismiss me for conduct for some other issue. The employer's case is obviously going to be those two things are unrelated. There's no correlation between the fact that you blew the whistle on something. You can dig into the detail of whether it was protected disclosure or not separately, but let's assume it was. So there's no link between that and the action we're now taking. And there's no, I think, one of the risk areas, there's no definitive time period. It's not like if you get beyond 12 months of a disclosure having been made, you then don't have to worry about, detriment and
The
dismissal,
link.
right? Because, the situation I saw, it was like 20 months later, somebody was made redundant as part of a wide redundancy process. It wasn't somebody being dealt with in isolation. It was somebody losing their job through redundancy, unfortunately, but part of a much wider change process. But that individual was able to persuade a tribunal that there was a link between something that was raised 20 months previously, and the redundancy situation that then arose, and that created an issue for the employer. So, I mean, that's a real watch out, isn't it, I think.
Yeah, and you do see that, and very often it's in your mind. Say for instance, using that example. So say for instance, you're in the middle of this wide-ranging redundancy, then you're looking at, well, it makes sense to me. It's logical. We've looked at performance. We've looked at this. We're looking at the assessment criteria. That makes sense. But the very often hidden issues are what's gone on between the complaint made 20 months ago and the decision. So, for example, the employer, the manager making the scoring could be biased or influenced, shall we say, by the fact that this employee had raised the disclosure. It may be that they're constantly banging on about it and the manager is, fed up with that. It doesn't matter, but ultimately, there could be little stepping stones all the way along the line from this original disclosure right through to any later decision. And sometimes it's impossible to find that out, right? Because, you only really find out when you dig into it when the litigation comes up. But, in terms of that situation, if you are in that situation and a manager is making a decision, it's always worth just stopping and challenging and double checking the information that they're giving you is actually going to substantiate the decision that you're making right there and then. I mean, that's all we can really advise on, in particular circumstances like that. But yeah, sort of like in terms of coming back to sort of policies and having these platforms in place, what can you do to help you navigate this? Well, it's making sure that your policy clearly sets out what kind of issues counts as disclosure. Usually it'd be fraud, safety risk, etc. And very often you'll say what's not covered, so purely personal grievances. Training your managers, I know repeated, we say it probably every single webinar, sorry. Training your managers to spot when a concern might escalate into a whistleblowing disclosure rather than a grievance as well, because getting ahead of it is always really useful. And then obviously having a clear route for how such disclosures are going to be handled, because there are essentially there's two parts to this whistleblowing. There's the need to investigate the topic. The subject matter of the disclosure. So my tools on the workshop example would be, oh, that's actually quite a good point. We'll need to look at that. We might need to tell people to put their tools away. We might need to revisit our risk assessment. So that's one part of it. And then the second part of it is obviously the retaliation point that Peter was just mentioning. So there are two aspects to it.
I mean, you mentioned about policy stuff there as well, and this kind of transitions nicely into the second point around the policy, procedure and reporting channels that you might have in place as an organization. On the HR side of things, having a clear whistleblowing policy, although we would recommend it, it's not legally mandated, but we would obviously recommend having one in place. But that alone isn't really going to be enough. You need a procedure that supports the policy as well, right? So, there are other facets to this, like how disclosures are made, how investigations are conducted, how anonymity and confidentiality is covered, how you're going to protect the worker who's made the disclosure as well, right? So there's a
Absolutely.
bit around
Yeah.
it.
So having your steps out in place. And there are sort of reforms coming up which anticipate having a more formal structure around this, and we'll cover the Office of the Whistleblower a little bit later. But it is a good moment to review your policy for future readiness. So, like key pointers might be ensuring your policy states that disclosures may go outside the normal line manager chain if they're needed, which would be to avoid retaliation. Making sure the person receiving the disclosure is trained in handling it. Monitor confidentiality. So things like habitual leaks or misuse of the process can very often undermine the trust. And also that opens the door to the retaliation arguments, right? So, an employee comes to you, they don't want it to go to their manager because their manager's involved, but somehow their manager finds out, and then all of a sudden you're starting to build that link for the employee to argue that subsequent action could be retaliation. Documenting every step. Once the disclosure is made, record what you do, because look, if it ends up in a tribunal, you'll need that audit trail, and we'll be the one saying, could we just have the documents on this? Could we have this? Could we have that? And we'll probably drive you mad asking those questions. But if you have a nice, neat, these are the steps we took. Here's all the information that you need. It puts you in good shape to be able to handle it.
Definitely. I mean, not least from an audit perspective for employment tribunals as well, because I can't remember if it was the last 101 session we had or a couple of sessions ago, but we were very much talking about paper trails and document creation and preservation in terms of being able to evidence decisions. It was a couple of weeks ago, actually. We were talking about that Alum case of the EAT, weren't we? That recording's up, by the way. Let's just talk about protecting the worker then and preventing the detriment. Actually, I'm going to mention now that Alum EAT session we did 2 weeks ago was quite an interesting dive into disciplinary processes. So that recording went live this week. So if you go on Spotify, you can find it. If you are listening to this on Spotify, because you're not joining us live today, please, please, please leave us a rating, because that just helps boost our visibility and reach and people who can see us. So protecting the worker and preventing detriment. The law protects workers from being subjected to a detriment, as I've mentioned, and employees from dismissal, if they make a protective disclosure. Now, detriment has a really broad definition, and just think of it basically as being treated worse because you've blown the whistle. So that could be a demotion, it could be receiving fewer hours in terms of shift allocations, it could be being isolated, could be being threatened at work as well. We've seen, all sorts of detriment examples. Bear in mind that co-workers who subject a protected individual to a detriment can be personally liable, and the employer is vicariously liable. So, although there's an all reasonable steps defence, think of it like discrimination legislation, where as an employer you can be vicariously liable for discriminatory acts that your employees conduct, but you can run an we took all reasonable steps to prevent this thing from happening in the first place. So clear policies, training of managers, the type of culture and environment that you've fostered. So there is that open to you, but you need to take and treat these disclosure processes quite carefully, right, Adrienne?
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's a need to deal with the subject matter, as I said. And actually, this is kind of useful to answer one of the questions that's been raised, because it seems appropriate to bring it in here. So the question is a good one. What if the employee is correct about the tools on the table floor or slash floor, and the manager resolves the issue? What happens next? So that comes back to the point that there are two aspects here. The employee may well have blown the whistle and said, this is dangerous, and they may have done it because that's exactly what they want. They don't want for their colleagues to be put at risk at work. So yes, it's rectified. That's great. The fact that they've blown the whistle is still there, though. So the employer's taken the right steps to put the matter right. The issue will then only become difficult if the employee later then says there's an act of retaliation. So, for example, having blown the whistle about the tools being dangerous on the floor, they then face redundancy, and they say that the reason they've been selected for redundancy is because they've blown the whistle. Now, the fact that the company's rectified it is actually irrelevant.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's been rectified or whether it was investigated and turned out not to be true. The point is, the employee had a reasonable belief and they raised it at the time. And that's kind of that is the stick in the sand. If the employee wants to then argue that because they did that, they're now suffering, then that's when we end up in difficulties, and that's when it lands on our desk. So equally, say, for example, the employee has raised it formally, and the co-workers get to hear about it, and the co-workers go, you dubbed us in, it's our fault, we've been told off for leaving tools on the floor, etc. And they then start behaving in a certain way towards the person who's blown the whistle. That's then something where the employee is suffering a detriment. That then comes into where somebody might be personally liable. To answer the second part of the question, is how can they be personally liable? So those co-workers, if they behave in a way towards the employee where they are suffering a detriment, the manager, for example, might not promote this person who's blown the whistle. So the employee would be arguing that that's the manager's decision, and they themselves have subjected the employee to a detriment because they complained about the tools. That's one bit. The vicarious liability is the employer has sat back and allowed that to happen.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about investigations and, outcomes and organizational learnings as well. Obviously, once a disclosure is made, you should be treating it seriously and investigating it appropriately. Now, that's not only because it's good practice to do that and because your policy might say that's what you ought to do, but it supports your defense as well if there is a tribunal process in the future. And, we know just looking at ACAS guidance, for example, they really emphasize respond to a disclosure, keep the worker informed, protect them, ensure you don't act detrimentally. And we know that tribunals like to scrutinize what an organization, does in these sorts of situations, right?
Absolutely. And that's when it comes under the spotlight. So you're looking at making sure that somebody independent is conducting the investigation. And that doesn't mean you have to go externally. It's just making sure that somebody has sort of is removed enough from the particular process or issue so that they can look at this with some fresh eyes. Keeping your records of your decisions, as we said, making sure that you've got your evidence, you've got your timelines, you've got your communications, and then consider whether there are wider risks to the organisation. Look at your regulatory requirements, reputational issues, example, and whether action's needed beyond this specific case. And just keep on top of it. Review the outcome. Record your lessons learned. That's really important. And consider amending or adjusting your process as time goes on, based on the investigations and the actions you've needed to take. All of that shows that you are taking this seriously, and that it's and that is a is good internal governance, but also deals with potential reputational risk. We are heading very rapidly towards 11:30, so I was just going to very quickly cover one bit, which is looking ahead. So what reforms are out there? And talking a little bit about this proposal to have an Office of the Whistleblower. So the government's actually actively reviewing the whistleblowing framework, and there is quite a strong move towards establishing an Office of the Whistleblower as part of the Employment Rights Bill. Now, we don't know if and when it will come into play, but I think it's still worth talking about because it does kind of show a direction of travel in terms of the sort of the internal governance. So some of the proposed functions of that office are going to include setting minimum standards for whistleblowing policies and reporting structures. Now, I personally think that that's quite a good idea because very often people will go, well, what's needed? So, it will give some guidance on what is actually going to be needed. Whether it's going to be organizational size relevant is something to be seen. We're looking at providing an independent disclosure and reporting service. And there are sort of like some public interest helplines out there, et cetera, which very often people put in their whistleblowing policies already. Monitoring and enforcing compliance with standards. I don't know what that might look like, but I should imagine things like encouraging HSE's involvement, perhaps. Don't know. Supporting whistleblowers, and I think this is important, and the talk is that they will have somewhere to go for advice, legal support, and to help safeguard them from any detrimental treatment. Now, I mean, that is a big job for the Office of the Whistleblower, and I think that's probably why they're going to think about it very carefully.
So it's going to be interesting to see kind of how much of that actually makes it onto the statute books once we get the Employment Rights Bill, kind of a webinar where we don't mention it, actually enacted, and we start getting all the outcomes to the consultations and the importantly the various regulations that the government need to provide to fill in the gaps, because we're all waiting for that information. So we will of course keep you posted on all of that. What can you think about in the meantime, though? Well, clearly the environment is changing. We know there's this focus on whistleblowing. We know that there's this focus on ESG within organisations as well. So there's a push to being seen to be doing the right thing for a variety of reasons. Some of the things that you can kind of get ahead on in terms of an in anticipation of some change is obviously reviewing the policies that you've got in place, benchmarking them against best practice, and anticipating higher standards is a good process to go through. Ensuring you can evidence you've got adequate reporting routes as well, that you've got training, that you've got independent investigations. Obviously, things need to be proportionate to the sort of organisation that you are I know some of you will have very few employees, some of you will have thousands of employees, and the approach that you're able to take may well be very different. You know, I'm thinking in terms of whether you have external whistleblower lines, for example, or if you have whistleblower lines that go to a group company level rather than within just a UK business, which I know some of, you know, some of the businesses we work with have. So see what's right for you, but that benchmarking exercise is really useful. Just prepare for possible regulatory oversight of the whistleblowing framework that you've got in place, and start thinking about your data and record keeping as well, particularly in relation to disclosures, because you could have to report up, you could have to open things up to be audited in the future as well.
Absolutely. So it's treating whistleblowing not only as legal compliance, but as, you know, governance and reputational issue as well. Getting ahead of it is, you're going to mitigate the risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Bang on 11:30. Before we close up, let's just have a look at some of the takeaways from today's session. So first of all, define clearly what counts as a protected disclosure in your policy and train your managers accordingly so people understand the policy that you have in place, because we do see that gap between training and understanding and what's just written down and put on the intranet. Secondly, ensure your reporting and investigation procedures are robust and that they're documented. Cover things like confidentiality, look at independence, look at timelines, look at feedback, how you actually help the worker. And that leads into protecting the worker, making the disclosure from any form of detriment. So monitor the treatment, ensure transparency in terms of communication as well. That's a big kind of elephant trap to avoid falling into, which is how the worker who's made the complaint is treated. Fourth, use disclosures as a trigger for organizational learning. So report lessons after investigations, report back, tweak things, embed improvements as well. It is all about learning from mistakes and tweaking things accordingly. And then, as Adrian's been talking about, with the prospect of an office of a whistleblower on the horizon, just prepare for change. So audit your policies and processes and be mindful that they may be opened up to external scrutiny, which obviously isn't happening at the moment.
Absolutely. And it's interesting just thinking about, you know, when you were saying using the disclosures as a trigger for organizational learning. So, you know, it very often look at it a different way. Don't look at it from a point of, well, someone's raised this as a complaint. Treat it as if it could be like a strategic signal. Someone's speaking up. Does it expose underlying culture issues? You know, think about it from that perspective. Is there an opportunity there to use that investigation to weed out things that could be done better and need to be fixed?
Definitely, definitely. Thanks everybody for joining us today. As always, hope the session really gives you some ideas in terms of legal fundamentals and some of the practical action points you can take away from this. We are going to be back, or at least I think I'm back in 2 weeks' time to talk about trade unions. So we're going to do a session in relation to trade unions. So if you have a recognised trade union at your organisation, if you work with trade unions, or if you've got the prospect of working with trade unions because of all of the trade union friendly changes in the Employment Rights Bill, join us in 2 weeks' time for that session. Otherwise, we'll get this session put up on Spotify very soon. And we wish you a good weekend when it arrives. So thanks, everybody.